Hello everybody, welcome to this episode of Vulcan Knowledge. I'm Sam, and I'm joined today by Inés Vascones Mula, all the way from Ecuador. Hi Inés, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you, Sam?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really, really interested to talk to you about a number of things today, and particularly something that's quite personal to you and your journey interacting with volcanoes. So I think this would be a great place for you to just tell us a bit about yourself, a bit of an introduction.
Sounds good. Thank you. Well, yes, like you said, I'm from Ecuador. I'm half German, though. So I'm a hybrid, but I was born in Quito. And I went to the German school here. Then I went on to study my bachelor's degree in Germany, still not knowing what I was going to do. And finally, I ended up after an internship at the Geophysical Institute here in Ecuador. I've ended up finding out that I like volcanology. So I did a master's degree in Bristol. And yeah, now I'm a master's back in Ecuador and waiting to see what else is to come.
Fantastic. So it was the internship that you did that really stoked an interest in volcanology then. So was your bachelor's in geological sciences, a general science background?
More or less. As I didn't really know what I wanted to do, it was actually a liberal arts and sciences bachelor's. So it was very broad. And one of the majors was earth and environmental sciences. And that's the one that I chose to do after a while, though. In the beginning, I didn't even know that was going to be my majors. And as part of that major, I did have some courses about volcan or geohazards in general.
So this internship you did then, what was the project that you were working on? And was there a particular moment that just made you decide, this is it, this is what I want to do? Because obviously you're surrounded by volcanoes in Ecuador.
Exactly. So I actually grew up surrounded by volcanoes, as you said, and I knew they were volcanoes. Like, I didn't see them as mountains, but I never saw them as a hazard or as erupting, or like, I didn't see them as something more than a mountain, even though I knew they were volcanoes. And as I didn't know what I wanted to study in Germany in this very broad bachelor's that I did, I had this one course on geohazards, and I had to do a presentation about Tambora, about the eruption of 1815. And that's when I realized this is what actually interests me, because it reminded me, like, the Tambora, which is like a big caldera, so it's open, it's a big crater, and that reminded me of Pululawa volcano, which is where I grew up. It's very close to Quito. And my mom has started to have a farm there when she got pregnant with me. And because her dream has always been to have a farm with horses, to do horseback riding with tourists, basically. So when I had this presentation about Tambora, it reminded me so much of Pululawa, where I had spent a lot of my childhood, that I thought, like, oh, maybe this is how it formed. Like, I never knew, because Pululawa also has a very big crater. So I just found a connection there that I didn't have with anything else I studied before or any of the other classes I had that I found interesting. But this connection started there. And then someone told me, like, why don't you do an internship at IG? And I'm like, is that possible? Like, is that a thing? Can you go there? Is that real? Because you know that from, like, the news, maybe. It's like, oh, if there's an earthquake or an eruption, someone from the institute talks. But it seems like something very far away. It didn't seem like something close or real that I could actually go to. And it actually took 3 or 4 emails to different people at IG until I got a reply. So I had to insist. And in the end, it was because of Pululawa that I got the internship. Because from IG, two people went to do information campaign at Pululawa to tell the people that live there about the volcano and what the hazards could be, to inform them a little bit. And my mom went to that reunion, basically, to hear about that. And then she asked one of the guys presenting for his personal contact so that I could contact him about the internship. And he was the one that actually replied in the end. So that's how I got my internship. And then that was the first place, like, when I was at IG, where I thought, I think I could see myself working here. Because before that, like, I had a lot of interest, but I never saw myself working somewhere in, like, such a specific place. Like, I could sit at that desk and work, and I could imagine doing that. And there I did. This community that they had there, I really liked it. So that's how it started.
Oh, wow. So that moment must have just really changed your whole perspective of Kuruzawa, where you'd spent so much time growing up, as you say, from looking at it through your course to then doing the internship. You must have just had a completely different mindset. I know this happens to us a lot when we learn about geology and the earth sciences in general. You'll never walk down a beach the same, or look at pebbles or look at a mountain or a valley the same after you've taken an earth science course.
Yeah, it changes a lot. Actually, on that note, like, there's so many trips I wish I could redo with the eyes I would see them now, because I went to Yellowstone, for example, in the US, and how could I have been there and not seen it as a volcano, right? Like, I don't know. I just, so many places I wish I could go to again. But
wow, when was that then? The Yellowstone trip, was that before you did your degree?
It was exactly just before I started my bachelor's degree. So in 2014, probably, yes.
So you say you wish you could go back there and see it with completely different eyes now.
Totally. but yeah, but IG at Pulalawa, like, it changed a lot. So my mom, like, we saw that Pulalawa just from what you see. It's like a big crater with domes in the middle, but you have to drive down a long road and you have like this big crater. So it seems as if at some point it would have been one big mountain, right? So you imagine the ends of this crater to at some point have been united at the top, and we're like, wow, this must have been a really huge volcano before it blew off the top, and then you have this big hole now. So that's what I thought, because that's what my mom had told me, and that's what she told the tourists when they went to Pulalawa to do their rides on horseback. And then I got to IG and I asked, because the guy I was working with was then my supervisor at IG, was had just finished his degree on Pulalawa. Like, he had done his thesis about Pulalawa. So, and I was helping with some samples. He still had to like analyze them a little bit. And then he told me, no, they're all domes. Like, they were never one big mountain. They're just separate domes that are just like in this shape. And in the middle, maybe something blew off, like it made this hole, but you never had like this union at the top. It was never a big mountain. And I was like, what I had believed my entire life, it changed completely.
I was going to say, there are so many prominent volcanoes in Ecuador as well. Most of the ones that you see, they're your classic tall, snow-capped, pointy volcano, whereas Pulalawa, as you've just described, is very different. And upon first observation to the untrained eye, you wouldn't come over, you know, that ridge and down that road and go, oh, this is obviously a volcano.
Exactly. So I never thought that. But then since I knew it was a volcano, I thought it must have been a pointy snow-capped volcano like the others. How can it be a volcano if it wasn't at some point at least pointy and snow-capped? Yeah, but it never was. So the domes actually have the same height they had. I mean, they eroded a little bit, but not much. Yeah, so it was very different. And when I told my mom and I tried to explain to her and the different units and whatever, and she was like, yeah, I'm going to keep telling the tourists the same story from before. This is too complicated. Can't explain that.
Yeah, keep it nice and simple and hand them a brochure if they need to look in more detail. So the ranch is actually inside I guess the crater and dome complex itself. It's not on the outside, it's physically inside it.
Exactly. So once you drive over the ridge and then you drive in for maybe half an hour between wall and ridge and hole, and you drive down, and then at the bottom you have a dome again in the middle, and right next to that dome is the farm, like my mom's farm with the horses. Yeah.
Wow. And so how when was the last eruptive activity there? Because is it very lush there now, or is it more of I can't imagine it being a barren volcanic landscape if it's got an active ranch and horse farm in the middle of it for tourists.
Exactly. So it's actually very lush, and it's actually more lusher than the like on the other side of the ridge. So when you drive from Quito, you actually drive through a very dry part. I think it's because it was deforested a long time ago to build then the Quito city from back then. But it doesn't rain much in the area, so it's very dry, actually, a lot of dust. And then you drive over this ridge, and it's super green, like, but huge plants, and you have, I think, more than 60 types of orchids in Pululawa, and a ton of birds. So it's a very, very lush area. And it's because it's opening, so this crater wall basically has an opening towards the northwest, and that's the direction of the ocean. So you go basically direction of the coastal lowlands. So the warm air comes in from the coastal lowlands and goes into Pululawa. And then there it becomes like you start having all the clouds and they can't really go out. So they don't go out over the ridge to Quito. So you basically have a cloud forest there, and you have like every afternoon, everything's white. And that's why you have so much flora and fauna there. But because of its shape.
This opening that it has towards the northwest, is that thought to be volcanic, or is that just more of a natural landscape feature?
So that's a little bit part of my master's thesis. So actually the part that's opened is very old. It's not part of Pululawa. It's like a pre-Pululawa structure, and it's oceanic basement, very old oceanic basement that was at some point accreted. And probably the volcanic activity of Pululawa, the explosive one, managed to make a hole into that. So this hole is probably due to the explosive activity, and it just eroded and destroyed this wall that you had naturally between like the coastal lowlands and then the highlands.
So that's quite interesting, that, because if until that had actually happened at the volcano, the climate within the center may have been very, very different. You were talking about, you know, how rich it is in flora and fauna before that opening was there to allow more of, you know, oceanic water and more of the weather systems in. It probably would have been a very different environment.
I think the shape plays a very important role, and that's why Pululawa is kind of special, because it's very close to Quito, but you have a completely different climate. You have this cloud forest, you have a lot of like flora and fauna, and on the other side, it's super dry. So it's like a really, really special system. And just before I forget, for your question that you had before, so the last eruptive activity of Pululawa was probably more or less 2,500 years ago, which for us seems like a long time, but for a volcano, it's not that much. It's not that long ago. And yeah, all this explosive activity, this hole that was built into this wall, was probably around 3,000 years ago. So only that's when this region started to be a bit different.
As you say, yeah, it's very, very young as an environment, as a microclimate, and the cloud forests. There are so many cloud forests around the world that are, well, how old are some of these cloud forests? They've been there for thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years sometimes. But this is an incredibly young system, both volcanic, but it's, as you said, on human timescales, it's a very long time ago. And I guess that plays into what people know about it as a volcano, or at least the general public might know about it as a volcano versus some of the more regularly active volcanoes in Ecuador.
And also, it's about the pointy volcanoes that are ice capped. Those are very well known. They look pretty, you can see them, they're like a big attraction. But for example, Pululawa, I always went there because my mom had her farm there. But friends of mine, or even like family of mine from here, they had never heard about it before, even though it's so close to Quito. So it's like 10 kilometers, I think, air distance, or well, basically Quito extends up to its flanks. So the northern part is really close. And even people living in the town next to it didn't know that there was, on the other side of the ridge, you had this completely different climate. Like they just saw it as like, oh, there's another hill on that side. But since it's not so high, you don't see it. It's not eye-catching if you don't go there and look over the ridge, right? So it's quite nice.
Wow, it must be quite a surprising moment for so many people, whether, as you say, if they've grown up locally and just not known what's literally over the other side of the hill.
Exactly. And even less know that it's a volcano and that it could pose a risk, because it's so close to the city that if there was an eruption, it would definitely have a very big impact. But yeah, it's not really how it's seen, actually.
So it's good that it's actually getting a lot more attention in recent years through your own work and through others' work as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why IG started also to, like, for example, do this campaign where my mom met the person that then gave me the internship at IG because they realized like something could be here. I mean, it's not very likely that it will erupt soon because its last eruption is not that recent, but it's still something to have an eye on, right? So, and important for the city also to know, and for the city planning, the urban planning, and for people who live nearby. But for example, my mom was a bit scared as well. She was like, oh, but don't make too much of a drama. Maybe then people won't want to come here because it might be dangerous, right? So
I imagine you have some people, say, arriving to the area, you know, going to see the botanical reserve and coming to the farm to do these tours, and maybe just not even knowing that they're then inside the middle of an old volcano.
Exactly. And even if they're like, oh, it's very old, right? Like, hasn't erupted. But if, as a scientist, you say, oh, actually, it's a young volcano, right? Like, for a volcano, it's just very young. And they're like, okay, maybe I won't go there. Like, what if it blows up?
Yeah, and I guess that really just highlights a point of how there's a very delicate balance between tourism and between, you know, wanting to educate the local communities and also people coming in from abroad as well. Because it's good, as you say, we need to know about these things for hazards and for risk. But this is also people's livelihoods at the same time.
Yeah, I think it was the same for Cotopaxi volcano. Because so my dad now lives in Germany, but when he lived in Ecuador, he was a mountain guide. So he basically, his job was to go up Cotopaxi and Chimborazo and Cayambe volcanoes with tourists as well. So, but now he's in Germany, but I still know that when there was this volcanic crisis in 2015 of Cotopaxi, they obviously closed the path up to the crater. And a lot of the mountain guides lost their, because Cotopaxi was like the main attraction for tourists to like hike up to. So when you weren't able to do that, the guides lost their tourists, like the people that could go there. And the same for Tungurahua, like some of the active volcanoes always had tourism, and it's a bit hard. Yeah,
so I guess that's something that's always ongoing. A few of the volcanoes you mentioned, Cotopaxi and Tungurahua, have been relatively frequently active over the past few decades. And so it's something that's very here and now and in people's minds.
Definitely. But also a very big tourist attraction to go and hike up there. So as soon as the eruption seemed that it might be over, the guides were like, okay, now we're taking all the tourists again. So sometimes it's difficult to know, okay, what could be dangerous? What is, on the other hand, like people's livelihood, and you have to give them a chance as well to like go there again. But it's sometimes delicate because you don't know with volcanoes. Like, it's just so difficult to know, like, if it might, like, if the eruption is actually really over now, or if it'll start again in a few months.
Yes. Right? So. And so for keeping, you know, the local communities educated, is this something that people generally know a lot about? Are there public outreach programs or the ways that, you know, city planners help, you know, inform the public about what to do in the event of hazards?
I would say no. Mostly from like city planners, like governments, they change all the time. They don't really know much themselves about the hazards at all. But I would say that IG is like the one institution that, I mean, they're kind of like responsible to monitor the volcanoes, but during these times where there's no active, like very dangerous eruption, where the only thing they can do is like react to that eruption. So when they have time to do this communication, they actually focus a lot on that as well. To do, they have some online course. Well, now they're online. I think before they were in person, some courses for people that live nearby the volcanoes to learn about that. So it's the idea. I don't know if you've heard of the vigías.
Okay.
For Tungurahua volcano. So that's apparently one of the first places in the world where they gave power and information to people in the local communities around the volcano. And they were the ones responsible to, for example, like they had always radio calls every 3 times a day. And they would say what they see of the volcanoes, if they see that it is erupting or not, if it's ash, if it's big ash, like to give all the information they can about the eruptions. And that gave them as well, like not only the information to know about the volcano and about its hazard, but also this responsibility of being the one that lets others know if something is going on, and also to call evacuations, for example. So I think that started because of Tungurahua, because there's a lot of like small communities very nearby. And since then, IG has tried also for other volcanoes, for example, with Cotopaxi, to also have these groups of people that they inform, and they also expect information from these people. So it's not just we teach you how it is, but you also give me your information. What do you see? What do you smell? How do you see the volcano today? And that's also very valuable, actually.
Yes, it is. It's valuable as scientific data at the end of the day. So I, as you say, it's really important to have those bridges with the communities. And I think that's something that is starting to improve in many places around the world. So these institutions recognizing to build trust and reassurance for the general public, that having one person or a small group of people that can relay that information to both sides is incredibly useful.
Yes, definitely. Because like the scientific things that are published often, like they're not really for the public. The public wouldn't really understand it. Like even the institutions in charge are often very like data oriented, and it's not very like made easy to digest or to understand. And I think that's a big step to also have this bridge for people. And I think they have also done some workshops with kids as well. Like IG has had a few. I think there's some schools that are more interested than others. Like they ask them, could you do a class? Could you do a workshop? And then they're very happy to do so. But yeah, so I'm also trying to help there a little bit with workshops for kids about volcanoes, because I think it's really important to have, like, to know these things since you are little. And I never did, like, until I was in Germany, like on the other side of the world without volcanoes at a university. That's when I learned about what actually is a volcano, what are its hazards. And then that related back to what I lived here all my life, but I never really knew that before. So
yes, I guess it really just shows the importance of delivering that information, because yourself growing up inside this system and just not really knowing about it in any way, and so being able to deliver that now yourself to the local communities as well, you're almost retelling that entire story. It's like, yes, I was in the same position that you were, so I'm delivering the information that I now know.
I never knew that volcanology was a thing, like that you could study that. Never. I never would have thought of that. And now that I have these, like that I do the workshops with kids, and I tell them I'm a volcanologist, and then we talk about volcanoes, right? And do these workshops. And afterwards, like many of the parents told me, like, oh, you're going to have such a big generation of volcanologists, because you never know about that. But if you know since you're little, it's so interesting. Like, not for everyone, of course, but I think there's a lot more interesting stuff in there than you would expect as well.
Yes. So what sorts of things do you do in the workshops then? Is it, do you do activities with them as well?
Yeah. So it's over Zoom because it started during the pandemic, but I think it was actually over Zoom before as well, because it's for kids that do homeschooling. So it's kind of like as a support for their parents, to also that the kids also have classes with other like people that have like are specialists in something else, basically. And I did a few things with, for example, so we simulated ash with a little bit of flour, and like so kind of like simulating the eruptions to build a little volcano, like with flour and water, and like to do these volcanoes yourself. And with honey, for example, we made the lava flows. So it's a bit of like understanding the different hazards and the volcanoes themselves by using things that you have at home. So that was the idea, basically.
It makes it really accessible to everyone if you have those materials, which is really, really good and important to do.
And definitely also having the relationship to the volcanoes, like, oh, so like I showed them a picture, I don't know, Cotopaxi, or then you have Bulalawa. So I made one exercise where I showed them different pictures, right, of these different volcanoes. And I asked them, do you think this is a volcano? Yes or no? And they had to like thumbs up or thumbs down. And for Bulalawa, no one said like, how can that be a volcano? Like, just look at that. So I think it's important for them to see, okay, volcanoes can look very different. They can have a lot of different shapes and all of that. I think that's very valuable, actually. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so for Pulawa, you said you went to do your master's in volcanology and here in the UK in Bristol, and yet you found yourself working on the Pulawa system.
Exactly. So, I mean, I did have it in mind since the beginning, because for some reason, even almost the day we started the master's, we were supposed to already have an idea of what we wanted to do for our thesis. And since we haven't had much of the classes yet, it's not like there was a lot of input from there. And I always was fascinated by Pulawa because of this connection of growing up there and knowing that it hasn't been studied that much, like that there's still so much more to study about it. So I told one of my professors, Catherine Cashman, about this idea. And she has also been to Ecuador and she was very interested. And she was like, yeah, let's do that. So she found that it was a good idea, but it wasn't clear what I was going to do. I just knew that I was going to come to Ecuador, take some samples as fast as I could from everything I could find, and then go back to Bristol and then see what I can do to analyze them. And then the pandemic hit, so I stayed in Ecuador just when I had all my samples, couldn't go back, didn't have access to laboratories either. So I started to think, what could I do with the samples at home, still as a thesis? So then I did just like the basics, just the grain size and the componentry at home. And it was really interesting to see how much you can actually find out about the volcano without having to use the lab, or without having to, I don't know, for example, go back to the UK to use, like, to Bristol, this fancy university with all the lab equipment. No, just at home in my living room, I could still find out so much. And that gave me ideas for the workshops with the kids as well, right? So I'm like, okay, I can show them, like, if you see these different types of ash, and it tells you a lot about the eruption already. So yeah, no, I think that was very interesting.
No, that's really, really fantastic to hear about that. And it also just kind of brings up a issue of almost accessibility and what that can sometimes mean for science. If you don't necessarily have access to some of these laboratories, can you still produce valuable science? If it's for publication or, like you say, for outreach purposes, you can still gain so much value in data and observations for teaching and learning so much. One of the wonderful things about earth science is being able to take something like a few grains of ash or a few grains of sand and being able to then talk about a system that's kilometers in size, just from small details.
Thousands of years old. Like, it's just, it's crazy. And I think that's very interesting. And that's what I try, or what I like about these workshops with the kids, because I think, like, if, of course, they go on to do something else, that's fine. But it's just so interesting to see how much you can learn from your surrounding just by looking at it, right? Mm. Like, just by being attentive and looking at the detail. And even just from the shape of a volcano, you know so much already, even if it happened thousands of years ago. And you can be a little kid and see that, right? And that's what I like a lot. Yeah.
Do you hope to get some of these kids out to some of the outcrops and areas someday?
It would be really cool. I think like pre-COVID, they used to have some like field days. And that's like, I thought about that, but for now it's not really possible. And I think also because of COVID, a lot of other families have joined this group of like homeschooling, and they're scattered all around the country. Like, I think there's even some in Galapagos, so it's not like you can get them together to go to an outcrop. Maybe the ones that would live nearby, but not everyone.
But I guess that also brings up another point for IG. So thinking about the volcanoes that IG monitor throughout Ecuador, that actually includes the Galapagos as well.
Yeah, exactly. So Galapagos is very different, like for monitoring, for eruptions, for everything. And that's also a place I would have loved to have gone to after studying volcanoes, right? Because it is basically a lot of big volcanoes in the ocean, and I never saw them that way. But yeah, it's really cool. It's funny because everyone loves Galapagos to go on vacation, but the people who have gone there, like to the big calderas after an eruption to take a sample or something, say it's horrible because it's so hot. You have to walk for hours to get there. And the lava is super spiky. And yeah, so I think to go on vacation, it might be nicer than to go to do research, apparently.
And I guess the islands are very separated in that sense. The ones that the people go to for more tourism and vacation purposes are not your active volcanic places like Sierra Negra or Fernandina.
Yeah, I mean, they do sometimes drive around with a boat from the outside to look at it, to see the fauna, yeah. Or to say like, oh, look, it's all black, it's all lava, but it's not the same as walking on the lava for hours, right? So,
yes, well, one of my hopes is to one day to hike up to some of those craters.
Yeah, well, I hope I can go back to too as well someday.
Well, we've talked about so many different memories and moments here, but I think it would be really nice to know if there's a particular moment or memory that just connects you with volcanoes on a personal level.
So there might be some when I was a kid that I don't remember because my memory is not the best, apparently. But my mom told me, and I think that probably influenced me in why I'm so interested in volcanoes, even though I don't remember it. But my mom told me that when I was like 3 or 4 years old, that's more or less, well, 95, 99. Okay, so I must have been 4 or 5 years old, actually, when Tungurahua volcano started erupting. And we went to see it, apparently. And we camped, like, in a tent on a hill, basically in front of Tungurahua. And my mom told me that it was, like, erupting, like, lava all night. Like, during the night, it looked beautiful. And she said that you could feel the rumbling, like, beneath us, like, beneath the tent. And that I was all night, like, I just went into sleep for 2 or 3 hours and then went out again to just stare at this volcano for hours. And I don't remember it. Damn it. But I'm pretty sure that was one of the most memorable moments I've had. But from the ones I remember, I actually really cherish the memories from Guatemala. So as part of my master's degree in Bristol, we had a field trip to Guatemala. And that's the first time I think that, the first time close, like nearby, that I saw a volcano erupt. And that was really, really nice. So Pacaya volcano was, I think, and just seeing how it evolves, like how fast it changes with like the different lava flows. And
yes.
So I think Pacaya was amazing, but probably I have a very nice memory from when I was 4 years old as well, somewhere.
Well, it's good that you have someone to tell you that memory as well, to keep it alive.
I can't pretend that I remember, but yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's really wonderful. Yeah, thank you for sharing that moment with us. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about these things. It's been really interesting just to hear about your personal almost full circle connection to this one volcano. And I hope that there's a lot more science and a lot more data and community interest that comes out of what you do.
I'm pretty sure it will be. It's evolving, but I think it's a very new topic that is moving a lot of people now. So yeah, I hope so. Thank you for having me.
No problem. And for anybody who's listening, I would encourage you now to play the game of volcano or no volcano by going and looking up a photo of Pululawa in Ecuador and seeing if you thought it would be a volcano or not.
I like that idea.
Well, thank you, Ines, for coming on today. All the best.
Thank you again for having me.